accept. I'm out to taste the truth. Tathagata's word. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm feeling particularly this evening like I'm faking it well, and they're going to find out. Do you feel that way sometimes? And what made me think about was, what is this tremendous expectation we have of some sort of perfect, authentic sort of expression or something? You know, what is that? What would it feel like if we didn't feel like we were faking it? Is there some real version of whatever our activity is as opposed to the fake version that's somehow different? So I was just, as we were chanting, reflecting on that particular brand of suffering, you know. Gets in there and gets you. Which we know we just are making up based on some message we picked up somewhere. And one of the things that I've always appreciated about Zen is that we have this sort of structure and formality, and so everyone just does their job, you know what I mean, whether they feel like it or not. So if Marty felt self-conscious about whether she was going to ring the bell the right way, luckily she just rang it, you know what I mean? She didn't just sort of sit there thinking about it for a few hours, you know. And likewise, giving the talk, you sign up to give the talk, and then you give the talk, you know. It doesn't matter what you think about it. And each of the different steps in practice are like that, and maybe the steps in life are like that too, you know. You have a kid, you don't get to say, well, actually, I wasn't really ready, you know. Or you get a job, and, well, you could, I suppose, with a job. You don't usually say, well, actually, you know, during the interview, I convinced you I was qualified, but I'm not. You know, please fire me, you know. You just go on, you know, you just do your best. So were any of you here for John Wiley's talk, I guess, 2 weeks ago? Couple, okay. I wasn't here, I was in Montana, I think, that night. But he gave me the notes, so I was reading what he said and really appreciating it. His wonderful emphasis he was making on, you know, the freedom and joy that comes from really just entering into whatever is happening. He spoke about being sick and how he always fights being sick, but now one time he actually really just got into it, you know. Refrained from grousing and watching TV and stuff like that, and he just lay there and was sick, and it was actually kind of pleasurable, he said. And he also told a great story from the Tibetan sage Milarepa that relates to his talk and mine also. And since most of you weren't here, I'll read you the story. I'll tell you the story about Milarepa. He was a fantastic 12th century Tibetan teacher. And I think they made a movie about him. Another one for movie night. You know. You can see them. And there's comic books and many books, you know, regular books about Milarepa. He's like a big hero in Tibet. And supposedly he was a regular person, but he had all these incredible powers. And he came to practice out of remorse. He had previously been like a sorcerer. And he had used black magic to kill people. So he had a great stain in his soul, which really motivated him. So he was a tremendous, you know, dedicated practitioner, famous for how hard he practiced, whether he had food or not. And he was always living in caves. And the traditional accounts say that there were many years where he ate nothing but some kind of nettle. And so his skin was really green. So he's this green kind of, you know, probably really well-looking, you know, no barber in the cave, you know, so crazy-looking guy. And he was living alone a lot, practicing. And the story John told was, one evening Milarepa returned to his cave after gathering firewood to find it filled with demons. And they were cooking his food, reading his books, sleeping in his bed. I think John is retelling it. I think John maybe transcribed this from Trungpa Roshi, because he says here, they'd taken over the joint, which is the kind of thing Trungpa always said. He was into using colloquial 60s English. And so he had all these demons in the cave. And he knew a lot about Dharma and non-duality, and the non-duality of self and other. He was a wise sage. He had an understanding of what demons were, but he didn't know how to get rid of the things. Even though he couldn't really tell that they were just a projection of mind, they seemed so real, so pesky, so troublesome. So his first idea was, well, he'd give him a Dharma talk. So he got up on his high seat. In the Tibetan tradition, they teach from these high seats. You ever seen a gompa? They have these really high seats, like up here somewhere. And he taught the demons about Dharma and emptiness and compassion. Taught about how we don't, our usual understanding is upside down. But nothing happened. The demons were still there. And so finally he lost his patience and he got angry and ran at them like screaming, and the demons just laughed at him. And finally he got up and sat down on the floor, gave up on the high seat, I guess, sat down on the floor and said, okay, I'm not going away and it looks like you're not going away, so we'll just practice together. And at that point, they all left, except one. They all left except one. So it was pretty good to just accept the demons and practice with the demons and say, okay, I'll just be here, you be there. You know, you have your space, I'll have my space, but we'll live together. That's pretty good, but not enough to get rid of all your demons. So Milarepa thought to himself, oh, this must be a particularly vicious demon. A really pernicious, yucky demon. And we all know that demon. We have that demon. Sometimes we have lots of that demon. Sometimes it seems like all there is. So maybe my demon earlier was the demon of self-consciousness or inadequacy. And so Milarepa didn't know what to do about this last demon. So finally he surrendered himself completely. He walked over, it says, and put his head into the mouth of the demon and said, okay, eat me up if you want to. And then that demon left too. So the moral of the story being, when the resistance are gone, so are the demons. So I thought that was a good story. And so I want to share with you the opposite of demons, which in a way is the same thing. Which is about a piece about joy, a piece about joy by our Dharma neighbor to the south, Chosen Roshi, at Great Bow Monastery, Zen Monastery in Oregon. She wrote a piece in their newsletter that they sent to me about joy. And she makes quite a few points about joy, so I want to read her point and then make a comment. She says, the Buddha described spiritual practice as a path to joy and happiness. There are several different kinds of joy that can arise when a person practices in a sustained way over the years. Here are a few. Many people come to Zen practice feeling dissatisfied with the religious tradition that they were raised in or previously explored. When they discovered Buddha's teachings, they may feel an instant fit. They rejoice to find that they are, after all, spiritual beings, and that their deep need to connect to the divine mystery can be fulfilled. They rejoice to find out that they are, after all, spiritual beings. I thought that wasn't accessible to them, but they find that it is. And that their deep need to connect to the divine mystery can be fulfilled. And this is the joy of discovering the appropriate path. The joy of discovering the appropriate path. And I think included in that joy is the other side. The challenge of never feeling really sure. Maybe it's the appropriate path. On a good day, it seems like it is, but what about a bad day? What about when we're caught in that sort of dynamic tension? Sure, not sure. Where can we find the joy and experience the joy of that uncertainty as well? If our joy is contingent on feeling certain, it would be pretty flimsy. But if our joy can include certainty and uncertainty, it becomes more solid. And there are a few people in the Sangha I've noticed that are feeling this dynamic tension a lot lately, for whatever reason, you know. It's like the late summer of doubt, you know, instead of the summer of love. So maybe we can appreciate that dynamic. Then Chosen says, when people first try meditation practice, they may immediately experience a kind of bliss. The feeling arises as the mind quiets. They're able to step aside from the mind's incessant chatter and from the world of anxiety and struggle that it creates. They enter a larger, peaceful field of awareness that surrounds the events that arise and disappear in the mind. This is the joy of discovering that you are not your mind. This is an important point. This is the joy of discovering that you are not your mind. And meditation practice helps us with this. On the one hand, it may seem to help us see that our mind is a complete disaster zone. So busy and crazy and spinning around. But as we either have this kind of experience that she's talking to, sometimes things just get quiet and there seems to be other possibilities for the mind. That's possible. But it's also possible to understand this joy of discovering that you're not your mind by just sitting for long enough and steadily and patiently enough with these crazy patterns until you realize they're just patterns. This happens and then that happens. The mind grabs onto this kind of things and sends me on this kind of loop, and then that ends and changes. And as we see our craziness as patterns, we don't have to identify with it. And that's another vehicle for discovering the joy that you are not your mind. And what's interesting about this is that we don't associate often feeling caught and confused with joy. And so this is a different way of considering the possibilities of joy. And so I've been getting some feedback from our late summer doubting friends about all kinds of little things, you know, little changes to the form and this and that. And I found myself becoming very reactive. Like, it pissed me off, you know, like, why are we talking about this, you know? Does it really matter if we stand this way or that way, or are the announcements here or there, you know? Don't we have bigger fish to fry, you know? And so I found myself not being very receptive or helpful. And I watched myself get tight, and I watched the inner dialogue take on a certain sort of temperature and flavor that it does. And I watched some long emails appear from my fingers. And then I watched it subside, and I realized, oh yes, this is how it goes with me. I get triggered, I react, I respond in a certain way, and I let go. And then when I've let go, on the other side, the mind is softer, it's more possible to be helpful, more possible to actually listen and feel the suffering of others, which is what compassion is. And so this is another way of discovering that you are not your mind. Your mind is conditioned and patterns are triggered, but is that really you? So can we enjoy going nuts, you know, coming out of it again? You know? Can we feel the joy of that? And the other thing that's great about recognizing that is that's when we have such potential for growth and awakening and learning. When we're sure of everything and confident and happy and relaxed, maybe not so much, you know. So this kind of joy is maybe not quite the same as what we say when we think of happiness. A little bit different quality to it. So next, Chosen Roshi says, upon discovering the Buddha's teaching, people often begin reading books, and they try meditation at home. And eventually they realize that it is difficult to practice in a sustained way alone. And so they look for a group of people to sit with. And they are surprised and delighted to find that there are many kinds of people who practice, and that underneath the many guises, lies the same human experience, the same call to transcend triviality and conflict, and to experience for oneself the unifying truth that underlies and unites all existence. That's a heavy sentence. I don't know if she would have actually said that. Let's read that again. They're surprised and delighted to find that there are many kinds of people who practice, and that underneath the many guises lies the same human experience, the same call to transcend triviality and conflict, and to experience for oneself the unifying truth that underlies and unites all existence. This is the joy of discovering spiritual friendship. And the Buddha emphasized this a lot, and you know, for good reason. And I think it's a particularly important message for us with all of our can sort of go it alone, figure it out myself, I don't need any help sort of conditioning. That we actually really need spiritual friendship. We really need community. And that there's a joy to that recognition of a shared understanding, which shines through sometimes, through all the other little things that go on. And you know, sometimes the joy of discovering spiritual friendship is really completely fun and wonderful. You know, we have a great time together. You know, it's nothing more beautiful than getting to be with people who are practicing. And other times, it's not fun in that conventional way. It can be difficult and confusing, like I was describing with my little loops. But there's a joy to that connection and that possibility. And there's a joy to that shared understanding of spaciousness and forgiveness. That we all have a sort of implicit agreement, you know, that no matter how crazy you get, I'll still love and appreciate you, and I hope the reverse. And so that's the joy of spiritual friendship, to have that comradeship along the way, no matter what happens. And Chosen goes on. She's got a lot of versions of joy. Isn't this interesting? Soon they realize the need for a teacher, for a guide, someone who is walking a few steps ahead on the path. And they hear the Buddha's teaching and see it embodied in senior practitioners. And they begin to have confidence that enlightenment is not only possible, but possible to experience for themselves. They commit themselves to a period of sustained and earnest practice. This is the joy of stepping onto the path and following it with the help of guides. So teachers are really just a version of a spiritual friend. And to really work well and, you know, usefully with teachers as spiritual friends, it's part of our work to open ourselves up and actually notice the teachers around us, to notice the good qualities of the guides in our life, whether they're formal Dharma teachers or other sorts of teachers in our life, family or friends or other people or animals. So our challenge is to open up and actually notice these good qualities of our teachers, but also to be able to do this in a realistic way. To see the guide with their positive and negative qualities, and to learn to discern our own projections and hang-ups and see the suffering that that causes. So we're not looking for somebody to tell us what to do, everything we should think or feel. We're not looking for somebody we should copy or emulate. But we really are looking and need to be looking for someone to help us find our way. And it might be that when they lead us down the wrong path, that's the most useful thing. We don't know. And then she says, as practice continues, people are able to recognize different difficult mind states, anger, jealousy, anxiety, and impatience. And they're eager to learn specific tools of practice that will act as the correct medicine for their mental emotional afflictions. When they apply these tools and experience relief of suffering, they become happy and confident about their own ability to walk the path of awakening. This is the joy of tasting for oneself the fruits of practice. Well, this can take time. Calendar time. Time on the cushion. The time devoted to trying longer sittings and different kinds of practices. Creative practice and patience. And yet we are all tasting this all the time. Sometimes we don't even notice the fruits of practice. Many times the fruits of practice are an absence of something, which can be hard to notice. You know, not reacting in a way that we always used to. Not getting upset. Not beating ourselves up in that old way. And sometimes the fruits of practice are positive and obvious. Being able to look at something, look at the flowers on the altar, and really see them, really appreciate the beauty of things as they are, and to really see the diminishment of mental afflictions, like she's saying. But in Zen, we're famous for not talking about results. Because when we worry too much about results, we know what's going to happen. We know that we'll just create more expectations and suffering. And we all know through long experience that the results of clinging, the results of trying too hard. So the fruits of practice arise naturally. We don't reach out for them. We practice as best we can, as skillfully as we can. And there are sometimes correct medicines and specific practices that you can take up, you can learn from books or teachers or spiritual friends. But a lot of times, the best practice is just steadiness. And the fruits will come when they come, just like in nature. The apples come when they're ready. And they're so delicious. So the joy of fruit, the fruit of practice. Then she says, when a person can feel that their pain is diminishing, and when friends and family testify to positive change, you're so much more patient since you began meditating. Faith is born. Confidence is born. This is the faith in the Buddha's teachings. Faith in the living teachers, faith in the ancestors, and faith in oneself. A student becomes eager to study and practice more deeply. This is the joy of hunger for practice. That's interesting, huh? The joy of hunger for practice. But sometimes I've noticed in myself and others, we often don't notice that as joy. We might notice that as incompleteness or, oh, if only I could go to more retreats, or if only I wasn't too busy, if only this, if only that, the hunger, I want more, you know. And so it's a nice reminder from her to see that as a kind of joy, you know. How wonderful that the mind is reaching towards wholesome states, that your heart's desire is aligned around letting go and awakening and awareness. And, you know, naturally, it's mixed up with all kinds of other stuff. That's just how the mind goes. But can we feel the joy of hunger for practice? And then she says, as the mind clarifies and a person is able to look clearly into the workings of the constructed self, they begin to see how much of their thought and action is motivated by ego, the desire to enrich and defend this cobbled together mass of conditioning and strategies for survival that we call ourself. Did you know that's what you were? A cobbled together mass of conditioning and strategy for survival. But there's a clear view of how much suffering. Then there's a clear view of how much suffering this constructed self has caused through our life, and how difficult it will be to disentangle ourselves from it and set it aside. This is the joy of true humility. So, in other words, the joy of recognizing, things, how things really are, how confused the mind and clingy the mind can be. Which also we do not associate with this, with the word joy, do we? But we can transform it into joy if we can understand it from the point of view of humility and practice instead of the point of view of failure and misery. It's also the joy of possibility. Oh, I see that I need to do something about this. There's a real possibility when you recognize that. And that's very joyful. And then she says, aware of the pain we have caused ourselves and those we love, we are willing to let go of our own set of flawed strategies for living a human life. We undertake a life guided by higher principles and formally taking refuge, receiving the precepts, or making specific practice vows. We step forth with renewed energy and purpose. This is the joy of deeper commitment to the path. So there's some sort of technical stuff thrown in there. I'll explain it later. But undertaking a life guided by higher principles, formally taking refuge, in other words, you know, really going for it, commitment. A life based on commitment to practice. This is the joy of deeper commitment to the path. And, a related one, when we make a public commitment, such as taking the precepts, we are asking our spiritual friends to help support us when our mind or heart become cloudy, or when we lose faith and begin to wobble. And it is painfully sweet when our friends move forward to remind, painfully sweet is good, to remind us, support us, or even prod us into remembering what is upright. When we fall again into suffering and are unable to extricate ourselves, it is a relief to know that there are people we can ask for help. People will understand the fear we face as we confront, take in, and benefit from the obstacles and difficulties of the spiritual path. This is the joy of taking refuge in Sangha. So these two seem to be sort of a little bit sectarian and specific line of practice, and seem to imply a kind of step-by-step process that we should all be going through, which is a sort of wonderful double-edged sword of religion, you know. That it seems to be, for religious practice to work, it helps to have structure, it helps to have goals, it helps to have things that we're working on and processes we do, it helps to have public ceremonies that are transformational, in which we expose ourselves and open to the community. But yet, as soon as we hear about these things or attend these things when other people are doing them, then it's natural to think, well, what's wrong with me? I'm not at that level. Maybe I'll never will be. Maybe I don't want to be. I'm against that. I'm not for that. And, you know, I have a position against religion. That's why I came to Zen, and now they're foisting these religious things on us. I think we should have meetings now. Talk about this. And I'm going to complain. So this is the problem. So the stepwise structured power of path is also a stepwise problem. And so our joy, an opportunity for joy here, is can we appreciate steps of the path from right where we are? Can we appreciate what they are for us? Without feeling judged by ourselves or projecting judgment on others, without feeling competitive. And I think there's a powerful dynamic there, which is underneath that, between our inner and outer life. Can we be true to ourselves and recognize who we feel we are, accept that completely, and realize it's okay. I don't have to do any of that. But at the same time, can we challenge ourselves a little bit? Because the self we think we have is not really what it is anyway, and what good is it really doing us? And so there's this sort of creative dynamic in all, I think, religious understanding, and especially it's very overt in Zen. On the one hand, everything is perfect. Everything is deeply okay, just the way it is. Practice is enlightenment. Awakening is our nature. And this is really true. And there's nothing we have to do. Our work is not doing so much as letting go of doing, accepting radically things in our life as Buddha, as just what they need to be. This life perfectly offered up to us, just the life we needed. And if you think about what other life could you have had, you know, I mean, it's like stupid, you know, to think you could have had a different life, you know. It's this particular set of factors came together, and the life that emerged for you is the only life you could have, right? So that's true on the one hand, that striving and trying to improve are endless and a source of great trouble. Our work is to let go of that, to accept things. But on the other hand, the opposite is also true. We have work to do. We were unskillful more than once today and yesterday and the day before. Our confused mind is causing trouble for ourselves and others. We are breaking precepts left and right. Our minds are clouded and distracted, and we miss out on the beauty of life. It's slipping by. And how many days or years do we have left? We don't know. And so practice is a matter of some urgency. It's also true. You know, we need to do these things. We need to do the steps and work hard. And so these two joys that she talks about, the joy of deeper commitment to the path and the joy of taking refuge in community and Sangha, speak to that dynamic. Joy of deeper commitment to the path includes the understanding that we're already completely committed, and there's much more commitment to be done. And how we work with this is very creative. We need to be sensitive and listen to our teachers about that dynamic. Sometimes we need to work a little harder. Sometimes we need to really chill out, really let go, really relax into steadiness. So I'm agreeing with her, but I think we need to bring up the other side so we don't all suffer, you know, unnecessarily. Then a few more. Then she says, one of my comments. Right. Then she says, then a renewed desire arises to see through delusion once and for all, to shed what is extra, to uncover one's awakened mind, body, and heart. We face the difficulty of letting go of the very glue that binds the self together and makes us function as a special but isolated self. This glue is tenacious, composed as it is of conditioned habits of mind and body, pointless thoughts and defended points of view, cherished memories and the emotions, happy or sad, that accompany them. So she says all this stuff is the glue, and the glue that holds together the self. So can we let go of that glue? If we keep on sitting, letting go, letting the waves of fear and restlessness settle, gradually we will open to an awareness of billions of separate sensations that float in a sea of emptiness. Joy arises, often tears, as the burden of self and the suffering it causes begins to dissolve. This is the joy of renunciation, letting go. So that was a whole lot more stuff. She's packed a lot of stuff in here, you noticed. And so here she is expressing the other side of striving that I was talking about. But it's letting go through clear effort. It's not just like snoozing. Maybe sometimes we need to snooze, but this is a very active renunciation. And renunciation is easily misunderstood to mean just, you know, giving things up, you know, beating yourself up a little bit if you don't give things up, and so on. But actually, renunciation, I think, really is the deepest form of joy. Renunciation is energetically and creatively moving into nothing. Moving into emptiness. Releasing ourselves from the stuff that we think binds us together and seeing what's between the cracks. What's in the gaps. What's beneath and around and glowing everywhere around this small view of self that binds us. So we're renouncing our fetters, basically, is the way it's understood. We're renouncing the things that bind us. And wouldn't you want to do that? Because that's a great source of joy. And, you know, and again, these things seem like, the way she's talking about this, it sounds like sort of a 20 to 30 year project, you know. And it is. But it also is unfolding all the time. And that's our challenge, to recognize that continuous unfolding of the whole path on every moment. And we can experience this directly during our daily lives. But it's easier to notice it when we're quiet. If we take a walk in the woods, sit meditation with the community, and really let ourselves sit. Maybe part of the Zazen period we're striving a little too hard. It's a little uncomfortable. Maybe part of the Zazen period we're sort of zoned out, sort of forget what we're doing. But then somewhere in there, there's a gap. There's a moment or a breath or a minute or an hour where awareness is just arising. Like she says, we're open to the awareness of billions of separate sensations floating in a sea of emptiness. And joy arises. We're just being. So this is the joy of being. The joy of renunciation is actually the joy of just being. And this is available to us all the time. It's just our habit. Comes crashing in so quickly, and we get busy or preoccupied and forget. But it's there. It's available. And then a couple more. Everybody doing okay? Okay, so we had renunciation, but now we have work to do. When difficulties and obstacles arise, whether from within or without, they may seem at first to be insurmountable. They may seem to be insurmountable. We know, however, that they have appeared in response to our sincere prayers to uncover our awakened nature. So that's good, huh? So when things seem completely impossible, that's really good. You can have faith that this has arisen in response to your practice, and it's really an excellent thing. It may not feel that way at the time, see? So this is a different take on joy, a more helpful, creative take on joy. In the living words of our chant, they are skillful means to emancipate us from our twisted karma. I'm not sure which chant she's quoting there. Maybe Fran would recognize it. Yeah, it might be a version of that, yeah. There is even a sense of anticipation as we face these challenges, work with them, pass through them, and find once again a simple happiness waiting for us on the other side. This is the joy of hard spiritual work. Hard spiritual work. Now, this is a little bit subtle, right? For one thing, you can only really recognize this for yourself. It doesn't do any good to tell somebody who's having a really hard time, oh, that's really great, you know. This is a fantastic opportunity for hard spiritual work. This is the best thing that could have happened, you know. You know, good thing that turned out that way, you know. That's not so helpful. So we can only recognize this for ourselves with support. But maybe sometimes we can recognize this. We can say, oh, this is horrible, I hate this. And maybe having heard these teachings and having grounded ourselves in meditation practice, it will be possible for the thought to arise. Oh, maybe this means there's about to be a turning, about to be a change. Maybe this is the suffering right before understanding. I just need to work with this. I need to stay with this, in other words. Because if we thought problems and difficulties were just something to be avoided and run away from, then this wouldn't function, see? If we just try to avoid problems instead of turning towards them and working with them, we don't have the possibility of this kind of small awakening through trouble, through challenge. If we don't recognize that all things are a teacher. Sometimes they say you can see your situation with dusty eyes or clear eyes. So the clear eyes are the eyes of practice. To say, oh, you know. And they're humble eyes. I don't really know what's happening here. I feel a strong sensation. I see powerful recurring thoughts. I feel a lot of sorrow and powerful emotions. How can I work with this? What is the possibility here? Then she just says, we discover that the practice gives us the tools to become energy alchemists. I like this part. Energy alchemists. That we can turn suffering into the very fuel for enlightenment. Anger into loving kindness. Jealousy into appreciative joy. Pain into concentration. Sadness into compassion. Gradually, our way of living and interacting with the world begins to change, and we begin to feel truly at home. This is the joy of transformation. And sometimes we can think about our afflictive states as fires, you know, that we feed through our habit. And she's saying, well, what if we could use that fuel in a new way? What if we could burn a purifying fire with our practice and offer our difficult states to that fire? Maybe they could be burned up and transformed like alchemy into joy. And this can also play out in a sort of experiential, experimental way in the meditation hall. You can experiment with this. You can notice anger arising and see, can I express loving kindness now in response to this anger? You can see jealousy arise and see if you can express that jealousy, transform it into appreciation for the other. And pain into concentration is very straightforward. You know, just don't move. You know, if it's appropriate for your body, just don't move. Pain will definitely turn into concentration. Because that's the only way you'll get through the period, you know. It works really great, actually. And sadness into compassion, into love. Okay, the last couple are short. And then a turning point comes. When we no longer strive to do the practice. Instead, the practice begins to live through us, infusing and animating all aspects of our life. Instead of relying on the discursive mind, we watch as wisdom flows out naturally through the channel of quiet mind. That's pretty interesting, huh? Listen to this again. Instead of relying on the discursive mind, so the mind of opinions and thoughts and concepts, right? Instead of only relying on that, we watch as wisdom flows out naturally through the channel of quiet mind. This is the joy of living in faith mind. Faith mind, she calls that. And then she has two more versions of the same idea. And when the mind learns to be attentive but at rest, when we are able to sit in complete receptivity, and this doesn't just mean sitting posture, it means being resting psychically in complete receptivity, suddenly each thing is in its true place. Everything fits together without a crack or a seam. This is the joy of perfect as it is. And when we're able to relax this push to be and become and improve and to allow the universal forces of our unrestricted universal mind to work through our individual body and mind, even to make use of our personality, there is a sense of wonder. Compassion and wisdom are always available if we are able to move out of the way. Energetic activity arises from a core of stillness. This is the joy of nowhere to go and nothing to do. So really different cast there on letting go, accepting things. Then she closes with, "May all of us experience each of these joys and many more as we unfold the wonderful practice of Buddha Dharma together." And I would add, may all of us experience these joys, and may we also notice that we already are experiencing these joys. May we learn to notice the joys that are arising in this way. And maybe we have a little bit of work to do here to change our habitual relationship to joy, to redefine joy a little bit. To think about joy as already present, maybe just obscure at the moment. And instead of asking, you know, where's the joy? How do I get more joy? How do I get happier? How do I get more? Well, what do I do? Where do I go? So instead of asking that, you know, what do I improve? How do I change things? So instead of that, to ask, what is the joy right here, right now, right in front of me? What is this joy? That's the end of my talk. Thank you for listening. So attentively and joyfully, regardless of your state. Maybe we've been sitting here a while, so why don't we have a little bit of time left in the evening. Why don't we stand up and stretch for a minute, and then just sit back down in our semicircle here and see what you thought of that and what we want to talk about.